And it's a great pleasure. You've heard me having a quick chat to Sarah, but Sarah was a huge supporter for me when I was working for the Macular Society and put me in touch with lots of useful people. And when she explained when we first met what she does and her particular interest, over the last 2 or 3 months, so many people have said to me that this is something that they also have an interest in. We've had one this morning already. So I'm not going to steal Sarah's thunder. I'm just going to say that Sarah is Dr. Sarah Bell, and that she has written a really interesting paper that I reread again called Another Time for Nature. And I'm not going to say any more. I'm going to let Sarah fill in all the gaps.
Oh, thank you ever so much for having me to join you today. It's really lovely to meet you, even if it's just on the phone for now. So I'm, as Judy very kindly mentioned, I'm a researcher and a lecturer. I'm based at the University of Exeter, but I actually live a bit further west, so down in Truro. I'm part of the European Centre for Environment and Human Health. But yeah, it's part of Exeter University. And I've spent probably the last 10 years or so exploring people's varied experiences of health and well-being with nature. And when I say nature, I mean in its absolute broadest sense. So, you know, from the weather that we experience as we venture outside the front door to gardens, parks, rivers, countryside, coastlines, and so on. And my work, I suppose, has had a particular focus on what can support, but also what can undermine those experiences, and how can we learn from people to really promote more socially inclusive opportunities to access and ideally benefit from time spent with nature. I think the pandemic has brought that home for quite a few people, both in positive and less positive ways, I suppose. But since 2016, I've been doing that research in collaboration with people with sight impairment. And that started with a 2-year research project that was called Sensing Nature. And that was when I first met Judy, I think.
I think it was.
So since that research project finished in 2018, I have been involved in a whole range of more practical projects that really try and put some of the learning from that research into practice. So I thought today I could spend 20 minutes or so, just sharing some of the headline findings from the research project in case they're of interest, and then chat a little bit more about some of the practical activities that we've been developing since in collaboration with various nature and disability organisations. I hope that sounds okay, but do shout if you've got any questions before I launch into it. I don't want to just talk at you. So.
Oh, bless you. They're very good at asking questions, Sarah, but I think we're all quite interested to hear what you're going to say. So we'll try and keep questions maybe till after you've spoken.
Okay, fab. All right. Well, just to sort of briefly introduce the key aims of the Sensing Nature Research Project, they were really to try and examine how people with sight impairment from all sorts of different backgrounds and kind of histories of nature experience and sight impairment, how people experience that sense of well-being or otherwise with diverse types of nature, and to then really try and improve the way that we understand, enable, and promote those more positive, inclusive, multisensory nature experiences. And I think throughout the work, we've been really trying to emphasize the need to progress from thinking about people's nature experiences solely in terms of disability, so potentially risking quite segregated experiences, to really understanding people as individuals with diverse nature interests and knowledge who may or may not have impairments of some kind. So in terms of the method, in phase one of the research project, I trained up as a sighted guide with Guide Dogs UK. I still do that as well, which is great. And I volunteered with a range of different activity groups around the country. So that was anything from kind of social groups to gardening groups, walking groups, blind rifle shooting down here in St. Austell, which was fab. And that was really to try and build my own awareness, I suppose, of sight impairment. Did have some close family friends who were going through it, but it, you know, obviously you all know it. Everybody experiences it a little bit differently. And then in phase two, I carried out in-depth interviews with 31 people living in both rural and urban areas around the country So I spent a lot of time on trains, which feels quite an alien prospect with the events of the last 2 years. But yeah, much of 2017 on the trains. And the participants in the research included men and women aged from mid-20s right up through to mid-80s. And people described a range of different eye conditions with varying impacts on visual fields and acuity, but also a whole range of different life circumstances that impacted on how they experienced sight impairment, but also got out into nature. And then, so all 31 people took part in an initial nature-themed interview, and this was really about exploring what nature was to them, how they experienced different types of nature during their everyday lives, how that had changed through different chapters of their lives, and also how they felt about nature access more widely. And then 25 of those very kindly took part in a second in-situ interview, so I went with them to a setting that they valued for supporting routine access to nature in some way. And those interviews were really helpful in, I suppose, providing more subtle insights into strategies used to negotiate these varied forms of nature in different weather conditions and all sorts of things. And they ranged from time spent in people's gardens to wandering local residential road and path networks to visiting urban parks, woodland, coastal and countryside areas. So I was able to get out into some exciting places. And after a pretty immersive process of transcription, so turning all those interview audio recordings into written documents and in-depth analysis, I set about trying to produce various outputs, organising various kind of training and capacity building activities to try and raise awareness of the work and the findings with key groups and organisations who may have some remit in enabling access to nature. So I'll give a mini overview of the findings now, and then I'll chat through some of those outputs and activities. So it's tricky to summarise all the findings into one talk, but I'll focus on four main themes that hopefully might be of interest. So the first theme was really nature as a form of connection. So our sensing nature participants, they highlighted several ways in which time spent with nature can provide valuable opportunities to build meaningful relationships with the world, often helping to counter feelings of isolation described by some people and to experience a sense of connection and companionship. Participants described the enlivening influence of nearby nature, be it feeling the sun's warmth or gaining a different sense of space and light. Many describe the soothing sensations of a calm breeze and the undemanding companionship of trees and birds, finding comfort in these gentle interactions with nature, rather than sometimes more complicated human encounters. I've got a lovely quote here from one of the participants. She was in her 80s, and she said, when I asked what nature is to her, she said, "It's life-giving, really, to me, nature. It's an awareness of the space that I can find myself in. And when I go outside, I'm aware of light, which I'm not always aware of inside. I'm aware of just the air and the sounds, the natural sounds around, which are very special. And when you can't see anything, the smallest sounds, even if they're bird songs, are very, very special. I think if I don't get out or involved with it, I feel very drab, very dull, very flat." And another participant in her 60s, she said, "You can be touched by nature even in a physical way. There was a woman that I worked with who had long-standing mental health issues, and I could totally relate to what she was saying because I experienced it myself as well. She used to like to feel the breeze and gentle rain because it's almost like, it's like being touched, but it's non-threatening. And so you know it's not going to hurt you, but it is a touch. So if a human touch might be threatening or has been abusive and that sort of thing, being touched by nature, you know, grasses, the breeze, gentle rain, it's all very sort of accepting. I mean, obviously it's all relative. If it was a hurricane force wind and torrential rain, it might be a different thing. And I'll come back to that actually in a bit. But so that was the first theme, thinking about this sense of being able to connect to something where you get that reciprocal interaction, but you don't necessarily get the demands or perhaps some of the negative aspects that can come from human encounter. So then the second theme relates to this idea of nature as freedom. And many participants described a sense of freedom through spending time in nature. And in one of the papers from the project, we categorized those freedoms as broadly social, mobile, and exploratory. So just to explain those a bit more. social freedoms were really about freedom from disabling social attitudes, disabling environments, and overprotective social encounters that perhaps fail to see past impairment to recognize and respect people's individual skills and abilities. Mobile freedoms really refer to people feeling able to move safely and to choose how and when to engage with nature. And for some, going beyond the limits of relatively short sensory trails or small sensory gardens that can sometimes fail to accommodate the joy of movement, so that kinesthetic sense, if you like. And then building on these mobile freedoms came the value of exploratory freedoms, to develop the skills required to explore new terrains in nature, from nearby neighborhood parks to coastlines, caves, and hilltops. Participant descriptions of these freedoms really emphasize the ways in which people can come to experience nature, not to master it and not to overcome impairment, but just to ground oneself in the world, to come to know it and to feel part of it. And again, there's a lovely quote here from a participant who I think was in her 40s. She said, "For me, the wonderful thing about nature is when I can step to a place where I can be free in my body and be quiet, but just with different noise, with natural, well, I say natural noise, but, you know, birdsong, trees, being able to hear the sound of a river nearby, different smells, it kind of makes me straighten up and feel less vulnerable, funnily enough. Whereas the kind of concrete and scaffolding and crowds and cars, lorries going past, people revving, all that tension, people, you know, emotional tension as well, people yelling at their kids or calling out after each other or car doors slamming, it's very wearing. So just to have a time when you can just be physical, really free in the body, to not have that constant anxiety about what's going to happen next." So I thought that quote just captures some of those ideas of freedom quite nicely. But this brings me on to the third theme, which is nature as changeable. So although it might often enable the sense of freedom, it also is often uneven, it's unpredictable, and that has both positive and negative implications. So a lot of the wider research on nature, health, and well-being often inadvertently frames nature as something quite static. So, you know, researchers will often use large-scale kind of vegetation coverage data sets from a particular point in time, and they'll look for associations with various population-level health outcomes. And obviously, whilst those studies often offer really valuable insights, you know, the studies that suggested that people living closer to the coast often report better sense of well-being, they also tend to fail to recognize the more changeable qualities of nature that can be so integral to people's day-to-day experiences. Mm-hmm. And these qualities came through really strongly in the accounts of the Sensing Nature participants. People talked about, you know, bulls appearing in previously harmless fields, sea swimmers periodically joined by jellyfish and Portuguese man-o-war. I remember on one of our go-along interviews, it was about an 8-mile hike through the countryside, and a participant had done it several times, you know, independently, and she was guiding us on the route. And then she said, "Okay, so at the next gap in the hedge, we turn right." And we got there, and I was like, "There's an electric fence there. I'm not sure if you want to go there." And she just said, "Oh, that's new. That wasn't there before." So then we sort of had to, you know, navigate this field edge until we could find a different way out. But obviously, if she'd come across that on her own, that would have been really unhelpful.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, you know, nature changes, but also the way people manage it changes, which can be tricky. But that the other aspect of nature as being changeable really is the weather, you know, that ever-present quality of everyday nature interaction. And many participants highlighted how somewhere could be completely transformed by the sun's glare, by dappling effects, by snow, by strong winds and loud, heavy rain. I think one person described snow as a sighted person's fog. And many commented on the unruly vegetation that reaches out along paths and pavements in the spring and summer, and how that often masks those really important tactile and auditory wayfinding cues. But participants also described how specific skill sets and endurance and resourceful improvisation often developed in collaboration with friends and family and professionals over time were essential to build confidence, to cope with and adapt to the vagaries of the weather, the seasons, and the often unpredictable comings and goings of nature's various creatures and critters, including humans. And that brings me to the final theme, and that was really nature as a place to develop new skills. So several participants discussed these moments of feeling like they'd lost nature as they knew it due to the sheer number of disabling barriers that they'd encountered with the onset of sight impairment in being able to experience, you know, nature as their circumstances have changed. And they described the skills and knowledge that they'd had to develop to engage with nature on their own terms. And they really emphasized these as qualities they'd had to work at. You know, they pushed against the idea that your sight goes and you develop supersonic hearing overnight, but actually, no, it's a form of attention that they'd had to kind of try to tune into, and how important that was in being able to continue to navigate and gain a sense of pleasure and meaning from different environments. So participant stories highlighted the development of what we, in one paper, described as skillscapes. So where skills were developed through these repeated encounters with diverse forms of nature over time. And this really ranged from participants likening the development of long cane skills to driving lessons. Another participant described the challenges of wayfinding in difficult weather conditions, even using string to navigate the back garden after heavy snowfall. And several participants highlighted the tricks that they learned to identify different plants and animals by sound or touch or scent. Some even described how they'd learned to climb and cave and kayak by touch and through careful auditory instruction. And that actually links to an important point, that this process of skilling up isn't restricted, shall I say, to people with sight impairment. You know, many participants highlighted the importance of building the awareness and the capacities of landscape designers, environmental managers, anyone involved in running mainstream nature-based activities like outdoor adventure providers and walking groups and nature conservation initiatives, they need to skill up too. You know, they need to understand how to support people with sight impairment to take part in meaningful ways. By identifying and working with shared multisensory reference points over time, activity coordinators could really enhance the quality of participation in these activities. And that leads me to the various sensing nature outputs and activities that we've tried to develop both during and since the project to try and, I suppose, support some of that capacity building. So alongside various informal, you know, training sessions and talks, we produced 5 main practical outputs from the project, and they're all available on the project website, which hopefully Judy can share with you. First output, it's a resource. It's available in large print, in audio, in Word, in PDF, so various different formats. And it's really for anyone whose lives have been touched or shaped by sight impairment in some way. It just shares some of the experiences of a range of people who took part in the study, alongside some of the kind of tricks and the strategies and the mechanisms that they've developed to maintain a sense of connection with nature at different stages of sight impairment. The second resource we developed in collaboration with the Sensory Trust down here in Cornwall, and it's an inclusive design briefing which features 10 top tips for designing and managing community nature settings with sight impairment in mind. And these tips are really trying to support, you know, managers of different green spaces, parks, landscape architects, designers, to try and promote physical, sensory, and social access to nature settings with dignity and to ensure that more people feel welcome and supported to visit. Now, the third output, we produced this in collaboration with Walking for Health and British Blind Sport, and that's a set of guidelines designed to help walkers make often, you know, pretty small adjustments to be able to include walkers with sight impairment. It sort of recognises the importance of tailored support in both specialist and mainstream walking groups to try and facilitate and share these walking experiences with sight impaired walkers in more meaningful ways. The fourth output was linked to an event that we ran in Bristol back in September 2018. So during the project, we came across all sorts of different organisations like Vision of Adventure, the Calvert Trust, Milton Mountaineers and Blind Veterans UK, who were all trying to support opportunities to experience a sense of adventure in nature, whether that was sailing or water skiing, climbing, caving, or other so-called risky activities. These organisations are really trying to support people to balance positive risk-taking with genuine skills development to promote otherwise somewhat elusive opportunities for wild and nature immersion. And we drew on that expertise as part of the Bristol event and produced a brief podcast from it summarising the key event conversations and talks, and that's available on the website too. And then the fifth output is a set of audio description and visual awareness guidance for staff and volunteers who are keen to support multisensory visitor experiences at natural heritage settings. And we developed this in collaboration with Vocalise, a national audio description organisation, the RSPB, and Andy Shipley, who is a visually impaired facilitator and sensory explorer, who I've been working with since 2016, and he's fab to work with and always just will come at something from a completely different perspective and kind of just reframe how things are being thought of. So he's fab to work with. But, yeah, we refined this guidance through a series of two-day training workshops at four different case study sites around the country. So we had a wetland site, a coastal site, a woodland site, and a more kind of managed kind of country park, national trustee-type organisation. So we tried to make sure it worked across those different environments. And then over the last 2 years, around the slightly crazy COVID teaching shifts and whatnot, I've been involved in a really exciting collaboration with Westernville Arboretum. So I thought I'd just spend the last few minutes now just sharing that. Again, just to give some background, when I was first writing the research proposal for Sensing Nature back in 2015, I spoke to a lot of different organisations who I hoped might be interested in the work. And through that, that's actually how I met Andy Shipley, who I mentioned before. And he, at the time, he had a blog, and in one of his blog pieces, he wrote, "I think the invitation to all of us is to explore and discover the diverse ways in which sites and habitats behave and express themselves, so we can work with them to reveal and share their unique and distinct stories, to delight and enchant all who encounter them." And that really struck a chord with me at the time. It got me thinking, how do we understand and share the different stories of the habitats that we visit, live, and work within, including the stories that are so often overlooked? And how do we do that in a way that resonates across the senses? And linked to that, how can we think more carefully about who is crafting and sharing these stories? I think so often when disability access and inclusion are considered across different nature settings, it's often in the context of visitor access, and it's often rooted in the aspiration to create accessible experiences for disabled visitors. And that narrow framing really overlooks the role of disabled people as curators of experience, you know, as potential site volunteers, as storytellers, as writers, as communicators. So in our current project with Westernville Arboretum, we've sought to bring people with sight impairment to the heart of one of Westernville's popular visitor experience opportunities, which is their program of guided walks and tours. So during 2021, we recruited and trained four new visually impaired volunteers to join the existing volunteer guide team. And we are fantastic guides, are Mark, Mike, Louise, and Barbara. And each of our visually impaired guides was paired with a sighted assistant if they wanted one, as well as an assistant guide with responsibility for health and safety during the walks. But together, the guides have really been exploring new multisensory ways of experiencing and sharing the Arboretum through the site's popular guided walks program. And through October last year, they've had their first program of sensory walks on site. And they've just launched, actually, their spring program for 2022. So they did their first one on Friday. And through these walks, the guides have really been enticing visitors off the main path to explore the rich textures, sounds, scents, and sensations of the Arboretum. And one person who he'd worked on site for 10 years in one of the food trucks, and he decided to join one of the October walks. And at the end of it, he said, "It's ridiculous. I've worked here for 10 years, and it's never occurred to me to go up close and touch a tree." So it's just all these things that people just hadn't really thought about. And another visitor actually wrote to us after joining one of the October walks, and they said, "New guided walks at Westernville offer a different way of experiencing autumn. Led by visually impaired guides and their lovely guide dogs, these walks encourage you to stop, feel, listen, smell, and think. You might become aware of the earth and the roots beneath your feet and the wind against your face. the rustle of the canopy or the chatter of children, the sharp citrusy smell of a leaf rubbed between your fingers, the knotty toughness of a branch. You might appreciate the astonishing dimensions of trees and develop a new sense of their form and structure. You might find words to record and retain your experience. All of this equals and enhances the conventional visual pleasure that most of us get from autumn at Western Burr. So that was a really nice piece of feedback that I thought I'd share. But each stage of the project really has revealed a range of different disabling barriers to participation that staff were previously unaware of, from, you know, core online training modules for volunteers to the fairly major challenges of accessing such a rural site without, you know, private transport, but also creative opportunities to start to dismantle those barriers. And the work is really based on the recognition that Western Burr will not be able to manage or really interpret sensory experiences that I can hear a good
we've got a bell going off somewhere.
No, it's good. Oh. Did I pause?
I think that's fine. It stopped.
Are we done? Okay. No, it's good. As to the soundscape.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but no, I was just going to say really that the work is rooted in this recognition that, you know, Western Burr, they're not going to be able to manage or interpret sensory experiences that the existing staff and volunteers are perhaps unaware of because they just don't tune into Western Burr in that way. I think so many people are preoccupied with the visual qualities of a place that they don't necessarily recognise the more subtle changes in temperature or texture or weight or sound or scent that people experience when moving through a site. Or, you know, how these sensory experiences might unfold differently if you're moving with a wheelchair or a mobility scooter, a long cane or a guide dog. So through the work, we've really been trying to make some of those unseen or rarely felt qualities of Western Burr's landscape more compelling across visitors with all sorts of, you know, varied backgrounds and histories and life circumstances. So actually, next week, we've got a whole program of activities where we'll be sharing the walks, but also we've got a soundscape installation, which is, it encourages people to imagine Western Burr through sound at different moments in time. And we also have an exhibition of artworks created by artists who experience all sorts of barriers to the art world, and they've spent some time on site over the last few months, and they've been restoring the landscape through their own perceptions and experiences. So hopefully that will all go off okay. But anyway, I'll stop there because I've been speaking for quite a while. But you know, do feel free to ask about, you know, more about anything that I mentioned or anything else, really.
Wow, Sarah, yeah, since I last spoke to you, my goodness, you've moved the project forward tremendously. I was just looking at your website, and I will make sure that anybody that's has an interest in this, I will share that website address with everybody. You've just spoken so well about so many of the things that we all have had to come to terms with, the lack of being able to get out and about over lockdown, and particularly for people with visual impairment, the loss of that connection with the great outdoors. And I'm just sitting here thinking, with the people that are on the call today, because we've got some extremely good movers and shakers on the call, but, you know, Western Burr, because the others won't know, but I was aware of that project because of the work I did with the Macular Society, because I know several of my members in Bristol area went to explore that. But wouldn't it be fantastic if we could persuade maybe Holden Forest down here just to take on a minute amount of the work they've done at Western Burr?
Definitely.
We need it here, don't we?
You know, we're organising a 2-day conference on site next week as well, and it's designed particularly for people from Forestry England, but also Natural England, National Trust, and what other organisations. But the aim is really to try to get them to experience all the things that you know, our fab guides have been developing, and hopefully to open up discussions about how it could be done in other places, because Holden Forest would be perfect for it,
wouldn't it?
It's a fab spot.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish you had been on a call that we had. We have a Wednesday call, which is a very easygoing, we call it a chit-chat call, and one of our members told everyone else that she had been out in her garden and had felt one of the branches of her trees, and she knew the spring was coming because she could feel the buds getting bigger. And so many people on that call said, you know, we'd never even thought to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's interesting. You were talking about the fact that, you know, that chap in that coffee place had never been out and felt anything. But that's because there's a perceived perception quite often when you go to any forest area, you shouldn't touch. We're brought up, aren't we, not to touch.
Definitely.
So sometimes it's people with sight who have as many barriers to experiencing the outside world as those with sight loss.
Definitely.
Because they have a perceived barrier. So I just think there's such an opportunity here. We've got some amazing writers within our group. We're going to explore that even further. We've got a wonderful storyteller and writer who's offered her skills to Devon in Sight, and I think knowing we've got poets, we've got people who are really good writers, we've got walkers, I know we've got a walker on the call, and when you said that, you know, basically the best people to describe a walker are those people who have sight loss.
Absolutely.
And I just think we need to really think about how all of our members could be encouraged to help everybody else really get in touch with nature, because you didn't use the word confidence, Sarah, but I suspect it's come up, because have you ever been able to prove that getting out into nature, whether it's a walk or even just into your garden, increases people's confidence with sight loss?
Absolutely. I probably forgot to mention it, but I think that's such a key part in terms of, it kind of comes with that process of building familiarity and skills, doesn't it? That you can take little steps at a time to gradually feel, to bring these different types of interactions into your comfort zone, I think. And it does take time to do that, but the confidence to do it is so important. And knowing that there's people around you who will, I suppose, help you through the initial stages of that is also really helpful at times.
I wonder what would happen if you went to a beautifully manicured park and started feeling all of the shrubs that had been carefully pruned. I don't know. Would the park keepers have a fit and say, get off my grass? You know, just sitting on the grass and putting your feet and your hands on the grass can relieve tension and all of that. So I think there's a lot of work for us to do, I'm guessing.
Well, it's funny with the discussions with Westenberg, because I remember early on they said people are so, as you said, people are so trained not to walk on the grass that they were really surprised that actually it's completely fine. They're completely allowed to walk on the grass.
Yeah.
And it's totally fine to go up and touch trees and explore things. But as you say, I think we're so socialised into just taking things in from a distance visually and not daring to go and get involved, that we don't do it. But it's such a missed opportunity.
And now is the time. Go on. Oh, please, Christine, go on.
Oh, hello, Sarah. Thank you.
Oh,
Karen. That was wonderful.
Hello, Karen.
Yes, no, I was about 3 minutes late, so I just
kind of
popped in. Yes, I'm the lady who talked about the touching of the branch and the feeling. And I spoke about the intimacy that actually, when one's sighted, you get the landscape. You know, you place yourself within the landscape. But I'm partially sighted. And what I've always felt, and even when I was sighted, is that when you kind of touch, you come close. And there's an intimacy and even a tenderness of touching a leaf, or I used to love to go and touch daisy leaves because they're so small, and there's an intimacy and a beauty, you know, that just shares. And also, where I live in Totnes, we have Dartington Gardens, and they have a plaque. They've had it for years, which says, please, we welcome you to go and hug the trees and talk with the trees. So, I mean, you know, I think even when I was fully sighted, I was very fortunate, you know, I'm a poet, so I'd like to, can I share a poem?
This is just
a very short one.
Yeah, please.
Okay. In the forest today, the softest rain to fall are these tears of my joy. Never again shall I leave thee, my beloved. Small wild flower, your shyness fills my soul. So for me, the nature is, it's within us and without us. It's so close and can be a beautiful healing.
That was lovely. That's fantastic. Karen, was that, do you know, immediately I saw a little wind anemone.
Yes. Yeah.
That was
wonderful. It was a violet, actually.
Oh.
But it's that, you know, that moment of kind of like just beauty of oneness.
Yeah.
And we're all interdependent. You know, we couldn't exist without the trees, we couldn't exist without the rivers and the oceans. And so we're all interdependent, and it's...
Yeah. I totally agree. I wish we could, if we could produce just a very simple sheet that encouraged people and put some of what you've just described, Karen, into words, because how many phone calls do we get from people who may be newly diagnosed with sight loss, who are frightened of this new world? And what you've just described, Karen, is a way of actually, having sight loss opens up a new world, because you are given permission to go and touch and smell and sit and listen. And that could be something in terms of your well-being. Sarah used that word, well-being, and you all know that's a big theme for Devon in Sight, is health and well-being, because we want people to live life well and get out and about and do everything you used to do, but in a maybe slightly different way. It would be fantastic if we could produce just something with some very simple suggestions about how to help yourself heal. And the simplest way is to
I'm
do
so
what
sorry,
you just
everyone.
Suggested.
I've just got to go away for 5 minutes. My man
Don't
has
worry,
come
Karen.
To put up railings. I'll be back in a sec.
How exciting. Don't worry, Karen. Join us if you can.
that was really moving.
As I said, Sarah, we've got some amazing, wonderful members of Devon in Sight. And their skills are way beyond mine in terms of art and poetry and music and life experience, to be honest. Sarah, have you ever been asked to come up with this sort of a leaflet that will encourage people to just maybe even if they're not capable of going out and walking through Westonbirt or Holden Forest, but to use their own back gardens or even open a window?
Yeah, so the Easing into Nature booklet that we wrote, that one tries to kind of take people through those first steps and then highlight, you know, the wider opportunities for perhaps when people have built initial confidence to then go further afield. So, but I'd be really happy to you know, distill out some, as you say, or, you know, to work with you if you like, to distill out more of a shorter kind of one or two pager, if that would be helpful.
That's like, I've literally, as you said that, I've opened up that document, and I know that many of our members would read perhaps an A4 sheet, but be put off reading much more. It would be lovely to lift, because this is really for sort of professionals, isn't it? And people that perhaps, I don't know if he's still on the phone, I could be dropping him in it now, because we do have the ability to record on memory sticks, and actually somebody reading this, we can perhaps record it. I think
I have done the audio of the whole booklet, but it is quite long.
Yes.
But I'm very happy to do more of an A4 sheet, definitely.
That would be lovely, because even if it was an introduction to this, and then we could then send an audio file. with the whole document, because reading it very quickly, I think there are things in here that it's a little bit like listening to a great book being read. I can imagine people will get lost in listening to you talking about this. So I think that's lovely.
There were some lovely things some participants talked about when they couldn't get out. I remember one person talking about Claire Balding's Ramblings program, and she said, like, just listening to her talk and imagining it felt like putting on an overcoat of leaves all around her or something. She described it far more poetically than I have. But
I love it.
Thinking,
It's interesting because Karen, who's just nipped off to sort her gentleman out, also, it was the instigator of us running one of our Wednesday calls out in the garden. So we're going to have a virtual coffee morning where if those who can will get outside and do just as you said, describe what they can hear, see, smell. It could be the cup of coffee if they're still inside. It could be they can hear their neighbours arguing. Or it could be, as Karen said, I'm sitting next to a rose bush and I can feel the buds getting bigger now. So we're taking a tentative step towards the journey that you're way down the road on. But it would be lovely if we could perhaps just make sure we're following your guidelines at the very least.
Oh, well, you know, finding everyone's own way of doing it as well. I can flag tips, but obviously I've still got a lot to learn.
Well, I think we're all on that journey. The others will know. Every day when I have these amazing people on the phone with me, I'm scribbling away and I learn several brand new ideas, new ways of looking at sight loss every single time. We always say that, you know, the experts are not the people sitting in the office. Our experts are our members. And they guide what we do and how we help everybody. So this wonderful conference you've got going on, I do hope there's going to be somebody from Holden Forest or the Forestry Commission that's responsible for Holden.
We invited someone from Holden. They couldn't come, but we've got three or four people from the Forestry England national team, including their volunteer coordinator. So I'm hoping that it will trickle out. But I'm
fantastic.
Also very happy to you know meet or chat to anyone at Holden as well. So it's hopefully
that would
be the start of the conversation.
please use us, Devon Insight, to say, you know, you have. There is great interest, because I've heard several people agree with me on the phone. It would be fantastic to have somewhere, even if people did have to, and you mentioned there that Western Burt is a challenge to get to on public transport, as is Holden. But it's actually, you know, I know some of my group members at Bristol, although they didn't necessarily go when we expected them to, there were a couple of people that got together and were able to find a driver to take them there, and they felt it was, you know, important enough to do that. So things happen, don't they? Not necessarily when we expect them, but it would be fantastic to have something. And I love you mentioned earlier on about making sure that it's every outside space that is open to the general public, if you like, should be encouraged to go down this route, because I was told yesterday that the oldest sensory garden is in Exeter. Who knew that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently, it's in Heavytree. If Gray's still on the phone, he might come in and tell me where it is in a minute.
Yeah, it's in Heavytree, and I can't remember the name of the park. No. I am here, quietly listening.
I thought you in the background, yeah. I've given you lots of work to do. It would be, but that does, it ghettoises people with sensory impairments, whatever that sensory impairment is, to go to an area of a park. Why should they?
Definitely. There's a National Trust place down here, and they've got this amazing massive parkland that goes through woodland and by the river, and the paths are all pretty good. And then they've got some lovely gardens. And then in this tiny, tiny, tiny little corner of the garden, there's this funny little triangular area that they call the sensory garden, and I have to say it's the least sensory rich part of the site, and you just think, why have you done that? Every time I look at it, I just don't understand.
and
Judy, it's Graham here.
Yeah.
It's Belmont Park in Heverty, Exeter.
Thank you.
A sensory area. Now, I've got to be honest, I haven't been there for a number of years, but it was one of the first sensory gardens made in the country, I think in the 1920s. I think it came out of World War One. So, our charity. So, a lot of people returning from conflict have been blinded in conflicts, and it was, I think that's how it developed. But I'm, racking my memory for that. It was a long time ago.
Can I say something about...
Go on, Karen. You're back. Well done.
Not this week's episode, but I think it was the previous week's episode. So it would be on iPlayer for anybody. Gardener's World had this, they have sections. And one of the sections was one of the Gardener's World team was visiting this wonderful blind gardener.
Andrew!
And he was amazing. I mean, it was so, he was taking you around and showing, and sensory, everything was sensory experience. And also, I've forgotten his name, but, he was blind. And he said, I really like to get out and do it, do it myself. And I actually gave a message to Christine because I left a message for her because of the last week when she was telling us about the Abbey and the sensory walk within the Abbey, because it was just so I had this huge smile after this section. So I think gardeners, partially sighted and blind gardeners are really coming into their own. They are actually looking in the centres, in the nursery centres, for plants that they can feel and touch and smell,
Sarah, you seem to know this gentleman.
Yes, there we are. He's based down in Cornwall, and he's got an initiative called Brian's Quest, and he's been making all sorts of audio-described YouTube videos describing his tricks and tips for doing different things in the garden. But he also visited a sand sculpture park in Western Supermare and kind of narrated that, and he's really passionate about all of these issues. He's fab. In fact, he'd be a great person to come and talk to you if you were so enthusiastic.
I mean, that was also really, I was just smiling all the way through it, actually.
Well, that says a lot, Karen. And may I tell you, what's his surname? So it's Andrew?
It's Andrew Hesser, and I have his details. But so he has an initiative called Brian's Quest, so I can definitely link you up if that would be
Bless
helpful.
You. I think because so many of people that acquire sight loss in early retirement are expecting to spend some very happy days doing their garden. And suddenly when this thing hits you out of the blue, I know from personal experience how much it hit my father, who spent his life gardening and had their garden re-landscaped three times. But one of the things I remember him saying to me is, no, don't pull out that clump of stingers, because I know then, if I hit the stingers, where the hidden little cyclamen are that will come up in the autumn. And it is sort of things like that, but, it's so important, so I think that would be fantastic. And that
definitely
all links in, doesn't it, to your things you were saying, Sarah, about noticing the little things that make the difference.
Definitely. And I think actually Thrive, the horticultural organisation, they, it was quite a few years ago, but they created a whole load of tools around gardening with sight impairment. So I'll take those out and see if the link's still there, because I could share those.
That would be fantastic.
Can I interrupt? It's Graham here.
Go, Graham.
I've just, funny enough, I've been doing some research for something we've got planned in the future. The Thrive website has a whole section on sight loss.
Yay!
I don't want to spoil what I'm funny enough, I'm in a text conversation at the moment with Monty Don, which is
wow.
funny. So,
ask him to come and talk. He's wonderful.
Well, I was hoping to get one of the other presenters who lives in Devon, and we haven't been able to arrange that, so I've gone straight to Monty, and I follow him on Facebook. So, we'll get something sorted. Can't make promises, but I'm working on it. I shouldn't say what I'm working on behind the scenes, just in case it never comes off. But yeah, we will do something about gardening. Right, I'm going to go back to my funding bid.
Bye.
But he'll pop up any minute if I say something he doesn't like. So don't worry, we haven't lost him entirely. One of our ambitions is to have a big event. Sometime, you know, we're not talking soon, but about almost like a living recital loss conference. The Macular Society used to do something called Top Docs, where they would get all the really headline consultants. But I've been wondering whether there is something about holding about a living in Devon with sight loss. And you could just imagine having Sarah there to speak about how important access, safe access to the great outdoors, whether it's your back garden or whatever, and with your background. Because we need to make sure people are living all aspects of their life, not just getting a magnifying glass.
Definitely. Or being,
you know, it's much more about that, isn't it? People just are defined by their sight loss, not about who they are and what their aspirations are for their future and their experience of life. So I think, Sarah, I'm sorry, but you've just got yourself a new little job.
Perfect. These are the types of these are the parts of the role that are fantastic. That's good.
Well, as you work at Exeter University, technically, I think that we can claim you for Devon anyway.
I think so. I'm very happy to be claimed.
Definitely. I do want to check that there are. I know Karen has probably got something, another question. But is there anyone else before that has a question or a comment?
Can I ask a quickie about the audio disc?
Go on, Les, yes.
Is the audio disc available on request? Because I like to use the sort of accessibility stuff I've got, and I find that audio can be really, really useful for pausing and taking note and having, obviously, a record there all the time. Is the actual audio disc available for to access?
Now, is it in your website? It's on. If I press Sensing Nature Outcomes, that's the audio description, isn't it?
Hang on, let me check where it is. I can't remember if the audio bit is in there or just
Easing
have a look
into
now.
Nature may not be.
Well, it is, but I'm not sure if it's there under. I'm not sure if the audio bit is there. There's a link to the audio files under that bit, and it's also on a news page. But I can send you. I'll send you the link, and if it's so, you can download the audio from there. But if it's easier to have it on like a USB stick or whatever, I'm always very happy to pop that in the post as well.
Oh,
so just give me a shout.
That's lovely, and I will talk to Gray when he's off doing it, because we might be able to pop that on an MP3 stick for you as well, Les.
Thank you.
I think that would be lovely, and I can see a bit something coming out in one of our magazines. I think we need to do something for all those people that weren't able to call in this morning, because this is far more important than so many other subjects that we talk about, because we know that it's going to have a big impact on a lot of people, whereas sometimes we might talk about very specific equipment maybe or specific issues that are only relevant to certain people, but this one is for everybody, isn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I know we've got people that are regular walkers, and it would be lovely perhaps if people have got a mobile phone that will record, they might have a little try of recording their walk in their way, a description of their walk, and it might be the obstacles, it might be the things, you stop here and you could hear the wind in the trees, it's particularly strong at this point. It would be lovely to have a bit of a go and just see what you can come up with. Wonderful. Well, that was amazing, Sarah, and I can't thank you enough for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely, and especially enjoyed the poem. That was really,
really
well. We can always put you in touch with Karen should you need someone else to help with anything you're doing in the future, and anybody else. But we have some amazing, as I say, amazing people on our call. Well, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough. And I hope all of you that are on the end of the line, we will be able to find all the contacts that Sarah's talked about. So if you want anything from me, Let me know, and I can make sure that we get that in the format that you need. So I'll say goodbye for now.
Thank you, Sarah.
Those of you who call in tomorrow, look forward to catching up with you all. Was that Mark on the phone?
Yes, it was.
I'm getting good at my voices. Excellent. So we've had a great turnout today, so I'm not surprised. I think lots of people were interested in this. And I hope that just one thing you've heard today inspires you to go into your own garden. And if it does, and
thank
if there's
you, Sarah.
Something you notice, let me know.